Chapter 17. Like beefsteak and potatoes stick to your ribs even if you're working your head off, so the words of the good book stick by you in perplexity and tribulation. If I ever held a high position over my people, I hope that my ministers would be quoting from 2 Kings chapter 18, verses 31 and 32, "Come out to me, and then eat ye every man of his own vine, and every one of his fig tree, and drink ye every one the waters of his cistern, until I come and take you away to a land of corn and wine, a land of bread and vineyards, a land of olive oil and honey, that ye may live and not die." 0 hour, Berzelius Windrip. Despite the claims of Montpelier, the former capital of Vermont, and of Burlington, largest town in the state, Captain Shad Ledoux fixed on Fort Beulah as executive center of County B, which was made out of 9 former counties of northern Vermont. Doremus never decided whether this was, as Lorinda Pike asserted, because Shad was in partnership with banker R.C. Crowley in the profits derived from the purchase of quite useless old dwellings as part of his headquarters, or for the even sounder purpose of showing himself off in battalion leader's uniform with the letters C.C. beneath the 5-pointed star on his collar, to the pals with whom he had once played pool and drunk applejack, and to the snobs whose lawns he once had mowed. Besides the condemned dwellings, Shad took over all of the former Scotland County Courthouse and established his private office in the judges' chambers, merely chucking out the law books and replacing them with piles of magazines devoted to the movies and the detection of crime, hanging up portraits of Windrip, Saracen, Hake, and Reek, installing 2 deep chairs upholstered in poison green plush, ordered from the store of the loyal Charlie Betts, but, to Betts's fury, charged to the government to be paid for if and when, and doubling the number of judicial cuspidors. In the top center drawer of his desk, Shad kept a photograph from a nudist camp, a flask of Benedictine, a .44 revolver, and a dog whip. County commissioners were allowed from 1 to 12 assistant commissioners, depending on the population. Doremus Jessup was alarmed when he discovered that Shad had had the shrewdness to choose as assistants men of some education and pretense to manners, with Professor Emil Staubmeier as assistant county commissioner in charge of the township of Beulah, which included the villages of Fort Beulah, West and North Beulah, Beulah Center, Trianon, Hosea, and Keesmet. As Shad had, without benefit of bayonets, become a captain, so Mr. Staubmeier, author of Hitler and Other Poems of Passion, unpublished, automatically became a doctor. Perhaps, thought Doremus, he would understand Windrip and Company better through seeing them faintly reflected in Shad and Staubmeier than he would have in the confusing glare of Washington, and understand thus that a Buzz Windrip, a Bismarck, a Caesar, a Pericles, was like all the rest of itching, indigesting, aspiring humanity, except that each of these heroes had a higher degree of ambition and more willingness to kill. By June, the enrollment of the Minutemen had increased to 562,000, and the force was now able to accept as new members only such trusty patriots and pugilists as it preferred. The War Department was frankly allowing them not just expense money, but payment ranging from $10 a week for inspectors with a few hours of weekly duty and drilling, to $9,700 a year for brigadiers on full time, and $16,000 for the High Marshal, Lee Saracen, fortunately without interfering with the salaries from his other onerous duties. The MM ranks were inspector, more or less corresponding to private, squad leader or corporal, cornet or sergeant, ensign or lieutenant, battalion leader, a combination of captain, major, and lieutenant colonel, commander or colonel, brigadier or general, high marshal or commanding general. Cynics suggested that these honorable titles derived more from the Salvation Army than the fighting forces. But be that cheap sneer justified or no, the fact remains that an M.M. Hellet had ever so much more pride in being called an inspector, an awing designation in all police circles, than in being a private. Since all members of the National Guard were not only allowed but encouraged to become members of the Minutemen also, since all veterans of the Great War were given special privileges, and since Colonel Osceola Luthorn, the Secretary of War, was generous about lending regular Army officers to Secretary of State Saracen for use as drill masters in the MMs, there was a surprising proportion of trained men for so newly born an army. Lee Saracen had proven to President Winthrop by statistics from the Great War that college education, and even the study of the horrors of other conflicts, did not weaken the masculinity of the students, but actually made them more patriotic, flag-waving, and skillful in the direction of slaughter than the average youth. And nearly every college in the country was to have this coming autumn its own battalion of MMs, with drill counting as credit toward graduation. The collegians were to be schooled as officers. Another splendid source of MM officers were the gymnasiums and the classes in business administration of the YMCA. Most of the rank and file, however, were young farmers delighted by the chance to go to town and to drive automobiles as fast as they wanted to. Young factory employees who preferred uniforms and the authority to kick elderly citizens above overalls and stooping over machines. And rather a large number of former criminals, ex-bootleggers, ex-burglars, ex-labor racketeers, who, for their skill with guns and leather life preservers, and for their assurances that the majesty of the five-pointed star had completely reformed them, were forgiven their earlier blunders in ethics and were warmly accepted in the MM storm troops. It was said that one of the least of these erring children was the first patriot to name President Winthrop the Chief, meaning Führer, or Imperial Wizard of the KKK, or Il Duce, or Imperial Potentate of the Mystic Shrine, or Commodore, or University Coach, or anything else supremely noble and good-hearted. So, on the glorious anniversary of July 4, 1937, more than 500,000 young uniformed vigilantes, scattered in towns from Guam to Bar Harbor, from Point Barrow to Key West, stood at parade rest and sang like the choiring seraphim, "Buzz and buzz and hail the chief and his five-pointed star. The U.S. ne'er can come to grief with us prepared for war." Certain critical spirits felt that this version of the chorus of Buzz and Buzz, now the official MM anthem, showed in a certain roughness the lack of Adelaide Targimich's fastidious hand, but nothing could be done about it. She was said to be in China organizing chain letters, and even while that uneasiness was over the MM, upon the very next day came the blow. Someone on High Marshal Saracen's staff noticed that the USSR's emblem was not a six-pointed star, but a five-pointed one, even like America's, so that we were not insulting the Soviets at all. Consternation was universal. From Saracen's office came sulphurous rebuke to the unknown idiot who had first made the mistake. Generally, he was believed to be Lee Saracen. And the command that a new emblem be suggested by every member of the MM. Day and night for 3 days, MM barracks were hectic with telegrams, telephone calls, letters, placards, and thousands of young men sat with pencils and rulers earnestly drawing tens of thousands of substitutes for the five-pointed star. Circles in triangles, triangles in circles, pentagons, hexagons, alphas and omegas, eagles, aeroplanes, arrows, bombs bursting in air, bombs bursting in bushes, billy goats, rhinoceri, and the Yosemite Valley. It was circulated that a young ensign on High Marshal Saracen's staff had, in agony over the error, committed suicide. Everybody thought that this harakiri was a fine idea and showed sensibility on the part of the better MMs. And they went on thinking so even after it proved that the ensign had merely got drunk at the Buzz Backgammon Club and talked about suicide. In the end, despite his uncounted competitors, it was the great mystic, Lee Saracen himself, who found the perfect new emblem, a ship's steering wheel. It symbolized, he pointed out, not only the ship of state, but also the wheels of American industry, the wheels and the steering wheel of motor cars, the wheel diagram which Father Coughlin had suggested 2 years before as symbolizing the program of the National Union for Social Justice, and particularly the wheel emblem of the Rotary Club. Saracen's proclamation also pointed out that it would not be too far-fetched to declare that, with a little drafting treatment, the arms of the swastika could be seen as unquestionably related to the circle. And how about the KKK of the Ku Klux Klan? 3 K's made a triangle, didn't they? And everybody knew that a triangle was related to a circle. So it was that in September, at the demonstrations on Loyalty Day, which replaced Labor Day, the same wide-flung seraphim sang, "Buzz and buzz and hail the chief, and the mystic steering wheel. The U.S. ne'er can come to grief while we defend its wheel." In mid-August, President Winthrop announced that since all its aims were being accomplished, the League of Forgotten Men, founded by one Reverend Mr. Prang, who was mentioned in the proclamation only as a person in past history, was now terminated. So were all the older parties, Democratic, Republican, farmer, labor, or whatnot. There was to be only one, the American Corporate State and Patriotic Party. "No," added the president with something of his former good humor. "There are two parties, the corporate, and those who don't belong to any party at all, and so, to use a common phrase, are just out of luck." The idea of the corporate or corporative state, Secretary Saracen had more or less taken from Italy. All occupations were divided into 6 classes: agriculture, industry, commerce, transportation and communication, banking and insurance and investment, and a grab-bag class including the arts, sciences, and teaching. The American Federation of Labor, the Railway Brotherhoods, and all other labor organizations, along with the Federal Department of Labor, were supplanted by local syndicates composed of individual workers, above which were provincial confederations, all under governmental guidance. Parallel to them in each occupation were syndicates and confederations of employers. Finally, the 6 confederations of workers and the 6 confederations of employers were combined in 6 joint federal corporations, which elected the 24 members of the National Council of Corporations, which initiated or supervised all legislation relating to labor or business. There was a permanent chairman of this National Council with a deciding vote and the power of regulating all debate as he saw fit, but he was not elected. He was appointed by the president, and the first to hold the office, without interfering with his other duties, was Secretary of State Lee Saracen. Just to safeguard the liberties of labor, this chairman had the right to dismiss any unreasonable member of the National Council. All strikes and lockouts were forbidden under federal penalties, so that workmen listened to reasonable government representatives and not to unscrupulous agitators. Winthrop's partisans called themselves the Corporatists, or, familiarly, the Corpos, which nickname was generally used. By ill-natured people, the Corpos were called the Corpses, but they were not at all corpse-like. That description would more correctly and increasingly have applied to their enemies. Though the Corpos continued to promise a gift of at least $5,000 to every family, as soon as funding of the required bond issue shall be completed, the actual management of the poor, particularly of the more surly and dissatisfied poor, was undertaken by the Minutemen. It could now be published to the world, and decidedly it was published, that unemployment had, under the benign reign of President Berzelius Winthrop, almost disappeared. Almost all workless men were assembled in enormous labor camps under MM officers. Their wives and children accompanied them and took care of the cooking, cleaning, and repair of clothes. The men did not merely work on state projects. They were also hired out at the reasonable rate of $1 a day to private employers. Of course, so selfish is human nature, even in Utopia, this did cause most employers to discharge the men to whom they had been paying more than a dollar a day. But that took care of itself, because these overpaid malcontents in their turn were forced into the labor camps. Out of their dollar a day, the workers in the camps had to pay from 70 to 90 cents a day for board and lodging. There was a certain discontentment among people who had once owned motor cars and bathrooms and eaten meat twice daily, at having to walk 10 or 20 miles a day, bathe once a week along with 50 others in a long trough, get meat only twice a week, when they got it, and sleep in bunks, 100 in a room. Yet there was less rebellion than a mere rationalist like Walt Trowbridge, Windrip's ludicrously defeated rival, would have expected. For every evening the loudspeaker brought to the workers the precious voices of Windrip and Saracen, Vice President Beecroft, Secretary of War Luthorn, Secretary of Education and Propaganda McGoblin, General Coon, or some other genius. And these Olympians, talking to the dirtiest and tiredest mudsills as warm friend to friend, told them that they were the honored foundation stones of a new civilization, the advance guards of the conquest of the whole world. They took it, too, like Napoleon's soldiers, and they had the Jews and the Negroes to look down on more and more. The MMs saw to that. Every man is a king so long as he has someone to look down on. Each week, the government said less about the findings of the Board of Inquiry, which was to decide how the $5,000 per person could be wangled. It became easier to answer malcontents with a cuff from a Minuteman than by repetitious statements from Washington. But most of the planks in Windrip's platform really were carried out, according to a sane interpretation of them. For example, inflation. In America of this period, inflation did not even compare with the German inflation of the 1920s, but it was sufficient. The wage in the labor camps had to be raised from a dollar a day to three, with which the workers were receiving an equivalent of 60 cents a day in 1914 values. Everybody delightfully profited, except the very poor, the common workmen, the skilled workmen, the small businessmen, the professional men, and old couples living on annuities or their savings. These last did really suffer a little, as their incomes were cut in three. The workers, with apparently tripled wages, saw the cost of everything in the shops much more than triple. Agriculture, which was most of all to have profited from inflation, on the theory that the mercurial crop prices would rise faster than anything else, actually suffered the most of all, because after a first flurry of foreign buying, importers of American products found it impossible to deal in so skittish a market, and American food exports, such of them as were left, ceased completely. It was big business, that ancient dragon which Bishop Prang and Senator Windrip had gone forth to slay, that had the interesting time. With the value of the dollar changing daily, the elaborate systems of cost marking and credit of big business were so confused that presidents and sales managers sat in their offices after midnight with wet towels. But they got some comfort, because with the depreciated dollar they were able to recall all bonded indebtedness and, paying it off at the old face values, get rid of it at 30 cents on the hundred. With this, and the currency so wavering that employees did not know just what they ought to get in wages, and labor unions eliminated, the larger industrialists came through the inflation with perhaps double the wealth in real values that they had had in 1936. And two other planks in Windrip's encyclical, vigorously respected, were those eliminating the Negroes and patronizing the Jews. The former race took it the less agreeably. There were horrible instances in which whole southern counties with a majority of Negro population were overrun by the blacks and all property seized. True, their leaders alleged that this followed massacres of Negroes by Minutemen, but as Dr. McGoblin, Secretary of Culture, so well said, this whole subject was unpleasant and therefore not helpful to discuss. All over the country, the true spirit of Winthrop's Plank 9 regarding the Jews was faithfully carried out. It was understood that the Jews were no longer to be barred from fashionable hotels, as in the hideous earlier day of race prejudice, but merely to be charged double rates. It was understood that Jews were never to be discouraged from trading, but were merely to pay higher graft to commissioners and inspectors, and to accept without debate all regulations, wage rates, and price lists decided upon by the stainless Anglo-Saxons of the various merchants' associations, and that all Jews of all conditions were frequently to sound their ecstasy in having found in America a sanctuary after their deplorable experiences among the prejudices of Europe. In Fort Beulah, Louis Rotenstern, since he had always been the first to stand up for the older official national anthems, the Star-Spangled Banner or Dixie, and now for Buzz and Buzz, since he had of old been considered almost an authentic friend by Francis Tasbrough and R.C. Crowley, and since he had often good-naturedly pressed the unrecognized Shad Ledoux's Sunday pants without charge, was permitted to retain his tailor shop, though it was understood that he was to charge members of the M.M. prices that were only nominal, or quarter nominal. But one Harry Kinderman, a Jew who had profiteered enough as agent for maple sugar and dairy machinery, so that in 1936 he had been paying the last installment on his new bungalow and on his Buick, had always been what Shad Ledoux called a fresh kike. He had laughed at the flag, the church, and even Rotary. Now he found the manufacturers canceling his agencies without explanation. By the middle of 1937, he was selling Frankfurters by the road, and his wife, who had been so proud of the piano and the old American pine cupboard in their bungalow, was dead from pneumonia caught in the one-room tar-paper shack into which they had moved. At the time of Winthrop's election, there had been more than 80,000 relief administrators employed by the federal and local governments in America. With the labor camps absorbing most people on relief, this army of social workers, both amateurs and long-trained professional uplifters, was stranded. The Minutemen controlling the labor camps were generous. They offered the charitarians the same dollar a day that the proletarians received, with special low rates for board and lodging. But the cleverer social workers received a much better offer: to help list every family and every unmarried person in the country with his or her finances, professional ability, military training, and, most important and most tactfully to be ascertained, his or her secret opinion of the MMs and of the corpos in general. A good many of the social workers indignantly said that this was asking them to be spies, stool pigeons for the American au gay payu. These were, on various unimportant charges, sent to jail, or later to concentration camps, which were also jails, but the private jails of the MMs, unshackled by any old-fashioned, nonsensical prison regulations. In the confusion of the summer and early autumn of 1937, local MM officers had a splendid time making their own laws, and such congenital traitors and bellyachers as Jewish doctors, Jewish musicians, Negro journalists, socialistic college professors, young men who preferred reading or chemical research to manly service with the MMs, women who complained when their men had been taken away by the MMs and had disappeared, were increasingly beaten in the streets or arrested on charges that would not have been very familiar to pre-corpo jurists. And increasingly, the bourgeois counter-revolutionists began to escape to Canada, just as once by the Underground Railroad, the Negro slaves had escaped into that free northern air. In Canada, as well as in Mexico, Bermuda, Jamaica, Cuba, and Europe, these lying red propagandists began to publish the vilest little magazines, accusing the corpos of murderous terrorism. Allegations that a band of six MMs had beaten an aged rabbi and robbed him, that the editor of a small labor paper in Paterson had been tied to his printing press and left there while the MMs burned the plant, that the pretty daughter of an ex-farmer labor politician in Iowa had been raped by giggling young men in masks. To end this cowardly flight of the lying counter-revolutionists, many of whom, once accepted as reputable preachers and lawyers and doctors and writers and ex-congressmen and ex-army officers, were able to give a wickedly false impression of corpoism and the MMs to the world outside America. The government quadrupled the guards who were halting suspects at every harbor and at even the minutest trails crossing the border. And in one quick raid, it poured MM stormtroopers into all airports, private or public, and all aeroplane factories, and thus, they hoped, closed the air lanes to skulking traitors. As one of the most poisonous counter-revolutionists in the country, ex-Senator Walt Trowbridge, Windrip's rival in the election of 1936, was watched night and day by a rotation of 12 MM guards. But there seemed to be small danger that this opponent, who, after all, was a crank but not an intransigent maniac, would make himself ridiculous by fighting against the great power which, per Bishop Prang, heaven had been pleased to send for the healing of distressed America. Trowbridge remained prosaically on a ranch he owned in South Dakota, and the government agent commanding the MMs, a skilled man trained in breaking strikes, reported that on his tapped telephone wire and in his steamed-open letters, Trowbridge communicated nothing more seditious than reports on growing alfalfa. He had with him no one but ranch hands, and in the house an innocent aged couple. Washington hoped that Trowbridge was beginning to see the light. Maybe they would make him ambassador to Britain, Vice Sinclair. On the 4th of July, when the MMs gave their glorious but unfortunate tribute to the chief and the five-pointed star, Trowbridge gratified his cowpunchers by holding an unusually pyrotechnic celebration. All evening, skyrockets flared up, and round the home pasture glowed pots of Roman fire. Far from cold-shouldering the MM guards, Trowbridge warmly invited them to help set off rockets and join the gang in beer and sausages. The lonely soldier boys off there on the prairie, they were so happy shooting rockets. An aeroplane with a Canadian license, a large plane flying without lights, sped toward the rocket-lighted area and, with engine shut off so that the guards could not tell whether it had flown on, circled the pasture outlined by the Roman fire, and swiftly landed. The guards had felt sleepy after the last bottle of beer. Three of them were napping on the short, rough grass. They were rather disconcertingly surrounded by men in masking flying helmets, men carrying automatic pistols, who handcuffed the guards that were still awake, picked up the others, and stored all 12 of them in the barred baggage compartment of the plane. The raider's leader, a military-looking man, said to Walt Trowbridge, "Ready, sir?" "Yep. Just take those four boxes, will you please, Colonel?" The boxes contained photostats of letters and documents. Unregally clad in overalls and a huge straw hat, Senator Trowbridge entered the pilot's compartment. High and swift and alone, the plane flew toward the premature northern lights. Next morning, still in overalls, Trowbridge breakfasted at the Fort Garry Hotel with the mayor of Winnipeg. A fortnight later, in Toronto, he began the republication of his weekly, A Lance for Democracy. And on the cover of the first number were reproductions of four letters indicating that before he became president, Berzelius Windrip had profited through personal gifts from financiers to an amount of over $1 million. To Doremus Jessup, to some thousands of Doremus Jessups, were smuggled copies of the Lance, though possession of it was punishable, perhaps not legally, but certainly effectively, by death. But it was not till the winter, so carefully did his secret agents have to work in America, that Trowbridge had in full operation the organization called by its operatives the New Underground, the NU, which aided thousands of counter-revolutionists to escape into Canada. Chapter 18.